This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Entik. My guest today is Dr. Wong Soo Long. He is a veteran journalist of over 40 years and author of Notes to the Prime Minister, The Untold Story of How Malaysia Beat the Currency Speculation. His most recent book is Being Abdullah Ahmad Badawi, the authorized biography, and that is the subject of our interview today. Dr. Wong, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
I want to start with the first sentence that you wrote on the back cover of your book, which is, Tun Abdullah Ahmad Badawi is probably the most misunderstood among Malaysian leaders. And for a politician who spent almost his entire career in public life, why does that misconception exist?
Well, you know, Tun Abdullah is a very low-profile politician. He's a person who doesn't blow his trumpet, doesn't claim credit to a lot of things he did. So he's a very low-profile politician. And when he became prime minister, not many people really knew about who Tun Abdullah is. Because you had this long 22 years of Tun Dr. Mahathir. One whole generation of Malaysians have actually grew up under Tun Mahathir. And when this person, his deputy, Abdullah Badawi, took over, a lot of people were not quite clear or not fully conversant with the man. And particularly as he rolled out his policies, they look very different from those of Tun Mahathir. And people said, what is he trying to do, you know? So there was a lot of misperception about Abdullah Badawi, made worse by some of his critics who put forward things which are not true. So in that sense, he's a very much misunderstood person.
So when did you decide that this is a book that you wanted to write?
I have thought about writing a book about Abdullah Badawi for a long time. In fact, from the time he was forced out of office, which is in 2009, I thought of approaching him to get him his cooperation to write this book. By the time, you probably know, it was not a good time because there was a lot of public disillusionment with him, with his leadership. And he was, in fact, shunned by many, many people. So I thought I would wait for a while to let matters settle down. And I feel that apart from being a person who is just very much misunderstood, I thought that the Malaysian public, Malaysian voters had given him a raw deal. And I thought that given time, as things settle down, Malaysians would probably take a more nuanced, less emotive view about Abdullah Badawi and will probably return a fairer verdict about his years as Prime Minister. So I waited about 5 years, 4 or 5 years, and the opportunity came at the Hari Raya open house where he asked me the question, Soo Long, when are you writing the second book? And I thought there was an opportunity for me to approach him a couple of days later to say, look, Tun, the other day you mentioned that, asked me when am I writing the second book. Here I am at your office, and with your cooperation and approval, I'd like to do a biography of you. And that's how the book started.
So you had an existing professional relationship with Tun Abdullah?
Yeah. I mean, I have been a journalist, as you mentioned earlier, for more than 40 years. So I had relationships with a lot of politicians, a lot of businessmen in Malaysia. So I know Abdullah Badawi for a long time when he was a young politician in UMNO, when he became a foreign minister, so it went on. But I never really cultivated him as a politician, as I never cultivated any deep relations with any Malaysian politicians. I like to keep a distance from them.
And after some time, books about him are now starting to appear. And was he not interested in putting out his own memoirs?
Well, he had been, he told me, he had been toying with the idea of, you know, getting someone to write his biography. I was told that he had two people in mind. And one of it was myself. So when I approached him, he almost without hesitation agreed to I being his biographer.
Being an authorized biography, what is the trade-off you have to make for that kind of access?
Yeah, surprisingly. I mean, I'm over the last 4 years, I met Tun Abdullah more than 50 times, you know, almost twice a month. And we spent long hours together in his house. He was a very easy person to talk to. He was humble. He was a gentleman. He never flinched from any questions I asked him. Like any authorized biography, the trade-off is, of course, you have to show him your drafts. And we would discuss the drafts. He got his assistants to help him to go through the thing. And we would look at it. And he would say, look, this chapter or this paragraph or this incident might not be that appropriate, you know. Or it doesn't reflect the moment at that time. So I would then modify it a bit here and there. And of course, writing a book of this size, nearly 500 pages, there are, when you begin, you make changes all the time, probably 20, 30 drafts, as you know, factual mistakes, dates, you got it wrong. Pala went through the book with a lot of care and we worked very well. So I really had no problems with him going through the book and making certain recommendations, which are few, I must say. In fact, he told me, look, Sulong, be as critical as you can about me. You know, I can take it. Because he's a person who would take criticisms provided they are given in the right manner, provided they are constructive. So really, I had a good working relationship with him when doing this book.
Is he a man who keeps journal? Does he have a lot of papers that you have to go through?
No, I must say, you know, Pala is a person who doesn't record many of his things. I don't think he kept a journal. Mm-hmm. You know, he did say that he has a lot of papers, but understandably, those are very sensitive material which will probably fall under the OSA, the Official Secret Act, you know. So we tend to leave that alone.
What got Tun Abdullah into politics?
Pala comes from a long line of religious teachers. In fact, his great-grandfather was in Mecca as a teacher. His grandfather, the very respected Abdullah Fahim, was born in Mecca. And he studied Islam and religion under his father and other religious teachers. And he emerged as one of the leading Islamic thinkers, Malay thinkers of his time. So, and then Abdullah's father, Ahmad Badawi, was also a religious teacher, but later he got interested in politics. At that time, in the after World War II, there was a lot of political ferment in Malaya, as was in Southeast Asia. So, grandfather and father were caught up in that nationalistic wave in Malaya, starting from the Malayan Union, opposition to the Malayan Union, the formation of UMNO, of which they were very early members. So politics is very much in the family, very much in the Pala's blood. And when the opportunity came, or rather he was being pushed, like Najib, into politics earlier because of the death of one, his political patron, Tun Razak, and within slightly over a year, the death of his own father, Ahmad Badawi. Now, Ahmad Badawi was a state assemblyman in Kapla Batas. So there was this question of who is going to replace him. So, of course, the people in Kapla Batas obviously look at the son as a logical replacement for his father. But at that time, he was not a resident. He was working in Kuala Lumpur in the Ministry of Youth. So he was not a resident in Kapla Batas. And in those days, you cannot be a candidate of a state seat unless you live in the constituency. But of course, things have changed. They have amended the law. But an opportunity came for him in 1978 under Tun Hussein On, the Prime Minister, then. And Tun Hussein was planning a general election. So he was looking for fresh blood all over the country. And Kapla Batas, he wanted a new person to represent Kapla Batas. One of the obvious choice, and finally the choice, was Abdullah Badawi.
So his career in UMNO was rising uninterrupted until the Team A versus Team B fight in 87. Why did Tun Abdullah choose to align himself against Dr. Mahathir?
Yeah, I mean, it was a very difficult decision for him. The split in UMNO, it was a conflict between two systems of leadership. In the old system, in the old days of the Tunku and Tun Razak, if you enter UMNO, if you are a politician, you wait your turn. You are given a lot of opportunities, particularly if you are young, to show yourself, to demonstrate your abilities, but you got to wait your time. There will be progressive elevation of your position if you are good, but you got to wait your time. But under Tun Mahathir, he, you can say, fast-tracked a lot of people. You know, the classic case was Anwar Ibrahim. He was taken in from ABIM, and within 5-6 years, he was one of the leading ministers in the Mahathir's cabinet. So because of that, the traditional UMNO politicians who took their turn, learned the ropes from the elders, felt that they have been bypassed. So that was the origins of unhappiness within UMNO. Then you have Mahathir, the master politician, wanting always to create a system of check and balances with him as the leader. So he sidelined Tunku Razali, who was then probably, after Tun Mahathir, was the most influential politician, very young, very dynamic leader. He sidelined Tunku Razali using Musa Hitam to fight Tunku Razali as for the number two position in UMNO, deputy president of UMNO, and he succeeded. And then later, he sort of reversed the role and used Tunku Razali to check Musa Hitam. As this was going on, you got the rise of Anwar, you got the rise of Tun Daim Zainuddin as a finance minister, very influential role. So you see that the traditional politicians, exemplified by Tun Musa, Rais Yatim, feeling very dissatisfied. You had the final break in the 2M administration. It was supposed to be Mahathir Musa administration. It turned out to be Mahathir Mohamad administration. If 2M means, it's just Mahathir Mohamad, just one person. So Musa was put in a position where his role in the party as well as in the government became quite untenable. So he resigned as deputy prime minister, and that triggered off the power struggle, which we know as Team A, Team B fight. And even the reverberations of the fight between Team A and Team B, which was about close to 40, 50 years ago, still reverberates even today.
How so?
Well, basically, if you look at the UMNO structure now, you could still identify people who had supported Mahathir, Team A, and you got people, even ministers, senior ministers, who were in Team B, supporting Team B. That schism, although narrowing over the years, still exists.
My guest today is Dr. Wong Soolong. He is a veteran journalist of over 40 years, and we're talking about his most recent book, Being Abdullah Ahmad Badawi, the authorized biography. We'll talk more after the break. You're listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Entik. If you've just joined us, my guest today is Dr. Wong Soolong. He's a veteran journalist and author of Being Abdullah Ahmad Badawi, the authorized biography. So after 1987, Tun Abdullah was sidelined by Dr. Mahathir. How did Tun Abdullah make his way back?
It was a difficult time for him. He was sacked as in the cabinet. He was then defense minister in the reshuffle after the Team A, Team B fight. Dr. Mahathir put his men and women into positions of influence and power in the cabinet as well as in the party. So Pala was sidelined, as well many Team B members like Rais Jatim, many of Musa's Hitam's supporters as well. In Malaysian politics, if you are not having a portfolio, if you are not a minister, life could be very tough. And life was tough for Pala. During the three years, 9 months where he was in political wilderness, he was shunned by a lot of people. He hasn't got any opportunities for patronage. And he had to live by a very small income, a pension as a member of parliament, some money from his work and Malaysian Economic Consultative Council. So it was a difficult time for him. Apparently, he had to sell one house to carry on, because in politics you need some money to run, to carry on. And he was difficult, but he was offered two jobs in between. One was the chairmanship of HICOM, the Heavy Industries Corporation of Malaysia. The other one was an ambassadorship to Brunei, both of which he rejected. The reason being, he felt that he's a politician and he wants to be a full-time politician rather than, you know, taking on a chairmanship or ambassadorship. But one thing about him is that He's always a patient man, been a religious man. He waited for his time. And he always maintained, although he was not a minister, he was still vice president of UMNO, one of the three vice presidents. And in that capacity, he toured the country, he traveled, he talked to a lot of UMNO grassroots leaders, very quietly, without much attention. And he was able to maintain those political links. And he later came back very strongly as vice president. Tun Mahathir, in restructuring the cabinet once more, offered him or made him foreign minister. So he bounced back into the government as a foreign minister.
I think it was Anwar's Wawasan team that challenged Abdullah's vice presidency in 1993.
That's correct.
How close was he to considering quitting politics altogether? Because like you mentioned, almost no income except for the pension from being a former minister as well as his position as a member of parliament.
Yeah, he always realised that, you know, there were always thoughts, particularly Endon was telling him, look, you know, I mean, it's a very difficult fight, you know, very tough. You are still young. You could still do very well in the corporate sector, you know. Give it a thought. But as I said, politics is in Pala's blood. And he realised that he would persevere. He realised that there is quite a lot of support within the among the UMNO grassroots that would sustain him. So that's why he continued as within UMNO, continued to move around the country talking to UMNO people. And he was rewarded very well when he came back as the vice president and later as a minister, the foreign minister.
So we arrive at the point where Abdullah ascended to the premiership. Was he ready for it? Did he know it was coming? And did he have a plan in place?
Yes, I think Pala was ready in the sense that you have to remember Tun Mahathir had been prime minister for nearly 20 years. He had three deputies which he cast aside, and Abdullah Badawi was the fourth prime minister. So, like any politician, he had thought that he had a chance to succeed Dr. Mahathir. In fact, months before Dr. Mahathir resigned, he asked Abdullah, he asked Pala, he said, Dola, are you ready to become prime minister? And the reply Abdullah gave was, sir, I am ready whenever you decide to step down. So, you know, Pala had some indications about Mahathir's intention, although Mahathir didn't tell him when he's going to step down. And then Mahathir dropped the bombshell at the UMNO General Assembly. At the end of the UMNO Assembly, he announced to the shock delegates that he wanted to resign all positions in the government, all positions in Barisan Nasional as well as UMNO. So that was a bombshell. And well, the rest is that, you know, delegates were shocked and refused to accept his resignation. Abdullah Badawi went to say, look, I mean, we cannot allow our leader to go in this abrupt manner. And it was decided after discussions that Mahathir should continue for another 16 months as prime minister. And after 16 months, he handed a smooth transition to Pala.
And not long after that, 4 months, I think, Pala called for a general election in 2004. And he would be remembered for two moments in his career, which is the 2004 historic gains in the general election and then the losing for the first time ever of the two-thirds Barisan Nasional parliamentary majority in 2008. What happened between 2004 and 2008?
It's looking back, it was obvious that the backlash of 2008 was inevitable. Just as the major, major victory of 2004, you know, swept Pala, you know, into the biggest victory ever. Pala is a person who takes things slowly. He promised a lot. He promised to reform the country. He promised to, reform some of the laws which were considered to be draconian by a lot of people, like the Internal Security Act, the Official Secret Act, anti-corruption, things like that. He did try, you know, but he met with a lot of resistance. But nevertheless, he took those resistance on board. And that was always his reform program. He never wavered from that. But because of the resistance, he was taking his time carefully. But the Malaysian public, the Malaysian voters, were rather impatient in those days. And they said, you know, look, after 2-3 years, you are not delivering. So during the next election in 2008, there was a lot widespread disenchantment with Abdullah and his leadership, disillusionment. And the voters turned against him and delivered a huge reversal against Abdullah. So it was one of the spectacular things where you are pushed up very high and then suddenly dropped down to the ground.
He was the first prime minister who called for an election in the social media age. Was his campaign team ready for that?
It was difficult for them. It was difficult for them. At the time, it was the flowering of the internet, the flowering of bloggers. You know, it was something new. Malaysians, particularly the bloggers, feel empowered with this new tool. You know, suddenly you are in your room and you write something, a comment or a story, and it goes around the world. You know, so as an individual, lots of bloggers and Malaysians felt empowered by it. But not so the government. All governments all over the world had to deal with this phenomena called a social network on the internet. And I must say, initially, the government under Pak Lah didn't know how to handle it. It was something new. There were two schools of thought in the administration. One said, look, we need to engage with the bloggers, the internet, the websites, you know, because it's an emerging communication tool, getting influential, although at the time it was still new. Then you got another group which says that, hey, you know, we should control it, we should ignore them, don't give them the respect, you know, they didn't deserve. And anyway, we have control over the mainstream media, particularly the major newspapers. With that, we are quite okay. So looks like the government was the second view, that we ignore the social media, focus on the mainstream media. That was the position taken by Abdullah's government, and that was a major mistake.
In that climate, among the fiercest criticism that he got was the influence that his son-in-law and the fourth floor boys had on his administration. Was it a fair criticism?
No, I don't think so. Looking back, in fact, like Zaid Ibrahim, the former law minister, said, without the fourth floor boys, Abdullah would achieve less, very much less. These are people who are well-educated, who knew what the country wanted, or at least the urge, the desire to open up the democratic space, the desire for reforms, you know, the desire to move away, not completely, but move away from the long reign of Tun Mahathir, 22 years, you know. But of course, they met with lots of resistance. There were two groups which were very sort of critical of the fourth floor boys. One was the old UMNO veterans who felt that they were sidelined by this group of young people. The other group was the civil service, the civil servants, who also, like the UMNO veterans, felt that the fourth floor boys were interfering with the running of government, that they were not consulted as senior civil servants. So these two groups were very critical of the fourth floor boys. Yeah, and of course, the rumors that the fourth floor boys were having an undue influence on Abdullah was spreading in the social media among the bloggers. And it was a mistake of the Abdullah administration not to tackle these questions head on with the bloggers. If they had tackled it and, you know, take them on, explain to these people, I think the damage would be greatly reduced.
Why didn't he choose to fight and stay on in power after GE 11?
Yeah, that will be the question which will Horn, I presume, his administration, his supporters for a long time, and including him. But at that time, he was facing really a shock. UMNO was in shock after losing 2/3 majority in federal parliament. They were in shock losing 5 states in the government, and particularly 2 important states, which was Selangor and Penang. They are rich states, urban states, and the momentum was being built up against Abdullah. There were efforts by the UMNO veterans, the warlords, to say, look, we can easily check this thing by getting a few opposition members to cross over to us, and then we can form the government, particularly in Selangor and Perak, which was very delicately balanced. But Abdullah would have nothing of that. He felt that the people have voted, the people have given their voice, and he respected that voice. So you have a situation where Abdullah was confronted with a very angry UMNO, particularly the warlords, a shock nation, a shock party, which has lost the 2/3 majority and 5 state governments. Abdullah could have continued as prime minister because whatever said and done, he still had a majority of more than 80 seats in parliament. And that was, by any criteria, a very comfortable majority of seats. But he realized that if he continued, he would have to fight the UMNO warlords, egged by Tun Mahathir. And he realized that even if he could stay in office, the UMNO party would be fractured, deeply divided. And he doesn't want that. After seeing the effects of the Team A, Team B fight, he does not want a fractured UMNO. So he decided to talk to Najib and discuss with Najib a peaceful transition to Najib. And Najib, at one stage, told him that, look, if you give me an early, you know, transition, early appointment, I would do my best to implement many of your policies, like the 9th Malaysia Plan, which was a lot of the projects there were still in the midst of, you know, being implemented here and there. Mm-hmm. And also, Abdullah realized that Najib would be in a better position to convince the party members to pass a lot of the reforms which he wanted to. So he decided that instead of having to see a very deeply divided UMNO party, he decided Najib should take over.
Abdullah rarely makes public statement nowadays. Do you think during his administration, he could have been more forceful in speaking out against extremist voices that were playing up to racial and religious tension?
He could. In fact, he has always been against extremism, you know, from any angle, whether it's from the Islamists or whether it's from the other groups, you know. But he at the same time realized that if you were to, you know, condemn these people, he has condemned them, but if you take action against a lot of these movements, you could further inflame tempers, passions again. So there is a neat balance in his administration. Some analysts and some of his supporters felt that he could have, in his early days as Prime Minister with such a big mandate, he could have cracked down on extremism, cracked down on some of the fundamentalists, you know. Well, that's water under the bridge. You could say he could or he could not, you know. But some people say that he should have done it early.
Given his stature as well, his Islamic credentials, today, do you think he has a role to play in pushing back against racial and religious polarization as well as the threat of terrorism and the Islamic State?
Yes, I think he has a role. What sort of role is debatable, but he is very concerned with the rise of extremism in the country, whatever form it takes, you know, and he's definitely very concerned with the spread, the rise of terrorism in the world, in Southeast Asia, and also in Malaysia. The present role he's playing seems to be one of a moderator. He sees that there are rising extremist groups here. He doesn't condemn them publicly. In fact, he likes to engage them, talk to them, caution them that, hey, some of the actions you do are very dangerous for the country. You know, you are bringing the country to the brink. And he would caution them. He felt that it would be better that way, privately cautioning some of these extremists than publicly criticizing them or taking them on. But there are groups which felt that because of his stature as an ex-prime minister who is now been seen to be a statesman, that he should take on a more active role. In fact, some people felt that he should take on a brotherly role, elderly brotherly role, rather than become a moderator. So, but at this stage, he's still acting more like a moderator.
Before I let you go, the former law minister, Zahid Ibrahim, was saying he would rate the Abdullah's administration, give him a 7 out of 10. Where would you rank him among our prime ministers?
Yeah, I tend to agree with Zahid Ibrahim. As a political leader, I would rate Pala, I would give him a 7, which is what Zahid Ibrahim gave Tun Razak. You know, I give him a 7. As time goes by, I think the public would begin to appreciate what Abdullah Badawi was doing. And he was doing a lot of good things, you know. During his short reign, Malaysia saw, it was the springtime of Malaysian democracy. I wish, you know, he had been given another extra 18 months to 2 years to push through a lot of the reforms. But as a man, you know, and I begin to respect him as a man, I would give him 8.5 in my, as I said in my book. He was a very genuine man, very humble, a real gentleman. He hates pretenses, lies, you know, and what you see in public is what you get in private. He has one persona. Most politicians have two persona, a private persona and a public persona, which most of the time could be very different. But Pala has only one persona. What you see is what you get.
I've been speaking to Dr. Wong Soo Loong. We've been talking about his book, Being Abdullah Ahmad Badawi, The Authorized Biography. Dr. Wong, thanks again for speaking to us.
Pleasure.
You've been listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.